Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
This is the Sports Edge with Rick Wolf on your flagship station for New York sports. The Fan, Sports Radio 66 and 101.9 FM, WFAN New York.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to a very special Thursday night edition of Rick Wolf's Sports Edge, and I'm your host, Rick Wolf. For well over two decades, every Sunday morning here on The Fan, you and I have been talking about the key and pressing issues when it comes to our kids who play sports. As I like to point out, those of us who listen religiously to WFAN on an everyday basis, well, most of us are hardcore fans of our teams, whether it's the Yankees or Mets, Jets or Giants, Knicks or Nets, Rangers, Islanders or Devils, soccer, you name it. Being a loyal fan is one thing, but when it comes to our own children who aspire to play competitive sports, well, that usually takes our passions to a higher and more involved level. That is, for sports parents, we've become obsessed with our sons and daughters who play sports. Why? Well, maybe it's because we truly hope and pray that they'll be good enough to earn an athletic scholarship for college. Maybe we hope that they'll be one of those rare athletes who can actually make it to the pro level and make millions of dollars. Or maybe we hope that if they're a star athlete in high school, then that would greatly aid them in their admission process into a top college. Whatever the inner reason is, what I do know is that parents and their obsession, and that's what it is, with their kids and sports has never been more intense. Now, a generation ago, it was a heck of a lot simpler to have been a sports parent. Why? Well, because back in the day, most kids just went out on their own. They played pickup games with their friends. Moms and dads really didn't pay much attention until their child got to ninth grade and started to play at the high school level. But we know that these days, there are all sorts of immediate choices that parents have to confront with their budding athletes. What's the right age for them to try out for a travel team? Shouldn't they specialize in one sport early on? What do I do or say if they end up playing for a bad coach? And on and on. Well, on tonight's two-hour special, you're going to hear from some of the premier people in the world of sports, and we'll be talking with them about sports parenting issues. You'll be listening to what they have to offer in terms of their own insights and experiences on how to be the best sports parent you can be. And what the future holds in store when it comes to sports parenting issues? Well, one thing I know for sure, it is a complicated topic. Later on in the show, the preeminent orthopedic surgeon, Dr. James Andrews, will be joining us to talk about his views on the future of kids who pitch and arm surgery. Is it okay for a kid to throw curveballs and sliders at a young age? What about throwing at full max velocity in order to impress coaches and scouts? We'll also be talking with Sonia Curry. She's the mother of Steph, Seth, and Seidel, about what her life was like before her kids grew up to become college and NBA players, and her daughter played D1 volleyball. Sonia, a former athlete herself and who's married to former NBA star Del Curry, will give us her thoughts on sports parenting and whether kids need to specialize at a young age. And remember, when those Curry kids were growing up, they were usually the smallest kids on their teams. Roman Oben, the former NFL star tackle, will also talk to us this evening about being a sports dad and having a son who was a top high school football player locally here in New Jersey and now plays at Duke. Roman serves the NFL in an advisory capacity regarding youth sports, and I'm eager to get his thoughts on football injuries and, of course, the future of concussions when it comes to youth football. But First up, I've asked longtime contributor to the Sports Edge, Wayne Mazzoni, to join me. Wayne is the pitching coach at Sacred Heart University in Connecticut, but he also happens to be a nationally recognized expert on the topic of college recruiting. And, you know, he's the author of several recruiting and sports books, which you can find easily on Amazon. If you ever want to reach out to Coach Mazzoni with a recruiting question, you can find his email and phone number posted on the Sacred Heart University website. Hey, Wayne, thanks for joining me this evening.
Rick, it's great to be here. It's just unusual to talk to you after breakfast time. So this is odd.
I was just about to say good morning to you, but I realized. Look, let me just say this, and I know, Wayne, you've been on the show many times in the past, and there are clearly very few things in high school sports that are more confusing and full of potential pitfalls than the college recruiting process. And the sad truth is it's only getting more and more complicated in the years ahead.
Oh, I mean, no question about it. Listen, just listening to your introduction of all these great people, in the back of my head thinking, God, I just, as a parent myself, we just want these kids to be happy. Don't we just want our kids to be happy? But I think being a kid now is harder than it ever was for our age, Rick, because between social media, internet, all the travel, you know, just what's blossomed has made it overwhelming for kids. And some are really succeeding and having more opportunities than we did. And some are getting kind of, you know, treading water and really struggling. So yeah. I hope we could tackle some of these issues tonight.
Well, and before I forget, friends, of course, we're taking calls with your questions at 1-877-337-6666. Wayne, let me just open this with a story I heard recently, and I think it reveals just how unfortunately naive some sports parents can be if they are not well-versed in how the recruiting process actually works. And if you don't know, it can backfire. Listen to this story. A talented high school baseball player who also happens to be a top student was making the rounds of colleges and meeting coaches. And along the way, one college coach said to him, and I admit I'm getting this secondhand, but the coach apparently said to this kid, you know, we'd love to have you attend our college and play for us. Well, the youngster and his parents were thrilled because that college, a D1 baseball school, just happened to be the boy's top choice. And to him, that simple statement from the college coach meant to the kid that he was being recruited. He probably even told his high school guidance counselor that he was being recruited by that college. But as the months came and went, it became more and more apparent that there was no more communication between the college coach and this youngster. Nothing. No official visit to the school, no calls, no text, no letters, no nothing. Now the kid may still be admitted to that college as a regular student, but he needs to know that while that coach said some nice things to the boy, the coach made no promises, and the kid is clearly not a recruit. Wayne, this is a cautionary tale, but again, you have to understand, if you're a kid in high school, you got to understand how the recruiting wars are played, and just because a coach says something nice to you does not make you a recruit. Have you heard stories like this before?
I'm torn because I don't really know any coaches, even rival coaches at, you know, these programs I'd love to be. They're really these good people that just want to coach good kids and run a good program. They're not like, they don't wake up in the morning and go, let me see how I could throw off a bunch of high school kids and upset them. So I think everyone's trying to do things on the up and up. So I'm wondering what this kid actually heard, because when you are being recruited, there's a lot of steps. You know, there's transcripts, there's NCAA clearinghouse, there's admissions, there's a financial aid package, there's visiting the school on a visit. So, like, there's generally not confusion on whether we are recruiting you or not. Now, there could be, towards the end, confusion on, are you getting a scholarship? What's your role going to be as a freshman? How many other people are recruited at your position? You know, what's your likely playing time as a freshman? But to think you're being offered a spot when it's not the case seems like that there's a major disconnect there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and I think there was a fact this kid didn't, nor did his parents, have any understanding of how this process works. But just to be told by a coach, gee, you're a nice kid, we'd like to have you here at the school and play ball for us, that's a nice sentiment, but does not in any way implicate the school or the kid. It's just a nice compliment. And as you said, it's a lot more multi-layered when it comes to the actual recruiting. But again, we'd like to think in this day and age that the kids who go through this process have a better understanding of what goes on. Wayne, and we're talking with Wayne Mazzoni, by the way. Wayne, let me ask you this. You know, we read all the time about some kid who's a phenom regardless of the sport, maybe it's basketball, whatever, but he's in middle school, or she's in middle school, or eighth, ninth grade, and she's been offered an athletic scholarship to a college. Are those offers to a kid who's in eighth or ninth grade, are they really binding on the kid, and they binding on the college too, even though the kid's not going to go to college for 4 or 5 more years?
No, it's a great question. So the reality is there's a lot of rules really set against those types of early offers. However, there are legal ways around it. So, for example, a kid may attend a camp, or a college coach happens to know that high school coach and asks the kid to make a phone call to the college coach. So certainly what you're talking about is there's almost, in my mind, two types of recruiting. There's the revenue-producing sports where it's intense, $1 million, national championships, alums, you know, ticket sales, and then kind of everybody else. So you hear about it, yes, basketball, football, those sports especially, where somebody does get offered very early. Now, in no way, shape, or form is it binding. It's a verbal offer. So many things have to happen. What if this kid has no grades to get into the school?
Right.
What if the two sides can't come to an agreement on the cost of the school, or a scholarship offer, something along those lines? So it is the coach saying, yes, we'd like you to play here, and the kid may accept, but that kid has every right to change his or her mind as the time gets closer. But there's also many things that have to happen for that actually to come to fruition.
So why would a college coach even do this? Just to, you know, basically tell the kid, we think you're really good, and maybe in 4 or 5 years, we'd like you to come to our school?
I think when you get to that level, and we know some of those, you know, names we've heard along the way, this is an exceptionally talented player. It's a quarterback in eighth grade who was already shaving, you know, looks like an adult. You could tell this person's going to play Division I quarterback. And that coach is thinking, listen, this kid seems interested in the school. We've made a connection. If I don't make some offer, you know, in a year, he's going to go somewhere else to another place and get that offer. So, you know, I don't think coaches, you know, a Nick Saban's waking up going, gee, I got to track down all the eighth grade quarterbacks. But if an eighth grader comes to an Alabama event or a camp and is throwing the ball 60 yards across the field, you can bet for sure some kind of conversation is going to happen.
Let's take some calls here with Wayne Mazzoni. Let's go to Sean out in Ronkonkoma. Hey, Sean, good evening. You're on The Fan.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Good. Yeah, I just did. You know, I've listened to your show for a while, and I love it.
Thank you.
Because you do touch on the issues that, you know, can be disturbing at times. But when I was a kid, I grew up very poor, and I knew that the only way that I was going to get to college was through my baseball ability. And I was a good player, and I think I probably worked harder than a lot of kids. But the pressures that I saw their parents put on them, particularly as I got into high school, was amazing. You know, why can't you be like him? Why don't you work as hard as he do? He does. He's got a scholarship to, you know, a major university. And I got to think that kind of damages the love for the sport, because I saw a lot of people, you know, a lot of kids that I grew up with end up hating the game because of the pressure that their parents put on them.
Well, you know, it is true, and that's all part of the whole world we live in now. And Sean, thank you for the call. You know, we live in the world, Wayne, we know, where a lot of parents, whether they're living vicariously through their kids or they're seeing that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, you know, within a scholarship or maybe going pro, yeah, the parents, sometimes it's inadvertent, many times it's for real. They put pressure on the kids to play at a higher level. And as we've said many times on the Sports Edge, that tends to basically eliminate the sense of joy or fun that the kids get when they play sports. And it's just the way it is. It's not good. And again, talked about the future of our sports. Yeah, I do worry about the fact whether we're squeezing the fun out of the games for our kids.
I can relate completely to what he said, and it's a shame. And I mean, there's a fine line. You do need to motivate your kids a little bit, but by a certain age, if they're not showing the passion for it, life's too short. You know, it's our job as parents to find what they are passionate about. Could be music, could be theater. There's a million things to get into.
Mm-hmm.
So if they don't have a passion for that, it's time to open up some other options to see what they do find a passion for.
I agree. You know, we've said many times, you may have your own dreams for your son or daughter who's an athlete, but the fact is, it's their life. Your childhood is over, but it's up to your son or daughter to decide whether they want to play sports. And if so, are they going to basically propel themselves to go out and practice on their own and be competitive?
Absolutely.
You can't, you know, you'd like to be able to motivate your kids, but unless that drive comes with from within them, that they were born with that drive, that inner, that innate drive to succeed, it's real tough.
And
as we know, it's a competitive world when it comes to sports. Let's continue on with our calls. Let's go to Tom in Berkeley Heights. Hey, Tom, you're on the fan.
Hey, guys, how you doing?
Good, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
So one of the things that people have to think about in recruiting is that you want your kid to go to a stretch school. So it's not all about the athletics. You need to get into a school that could do better for you if you're not going to be playing that sport and going professional.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter was a D1 athlete. She committed in her junior year, and I was appalled that the coaches were ready to make a verbal offer to her, but they stuck by it, and she was committed and fully bought into the program, even though she didn't play until her middle of her junior year.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just deal with playing time and the, I would say, it's playing time, you're a sports psychologist, but also the expectations of the kid, because they come from the big fish in the little pond in high school to going to a big pond where they're the little fish. Everybody was a captain. Everybody was all state.
Yeah,
of course.
Absolutely.
Yes.
At any level, even D3, no question.
Yep, absolutely. And I don't think these kids realize that when they're juniors and seniors in high school. They think that, you know, all state, I'm going to start day one. You have to put in the work.
Tom,
and
this is how...
Right.
Tom, thank you for the call. And Wayne, you and I both know that's the reality. I mean, you obviously see it every day at Sacred Heart. Every kid who plays in college is all league, all county, all state, all world, whatever it might be.
Absolutely. And he was saying at the beginning of that call, I mean, there are so many college choices out there. If you're a legitimate person that's going to play at that next level, you should be able to find a school that has everything you want, the right setting, the right distance from home, the right major, good academic fit. To just make the sport only lead the way is kind of a shame, because if that sport doesn't work out, you're not happy with your college experience. So I always tell people, I mean, you're the customer. Colleges are expensive, and you're the one kind of shopping. It's like if you're looking for a car, I mean, you're the one buying. So, yes, kids are on the side going, my God, I want anybody to like me. But if you are going to be recruited, it's probably going to be by several schools, usually a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to be a talented player, and you got to find the place that's you feel at home, you feel comfortable.
Yeah, I think, and that's, of course, the downside that people don't want to talk about too much. But the fact is that, yeah, you might end up going to a program and, you know, the competition is just a little stiffer than you thought. You never see the field. You just start to wonder whether or not I really want to keep playing this sport. I mean, that's what happens to a lot of athletes who are superstars in high school, because that jump from high school to the collegiate ranks, particularly at the D1 level, is very, very jump. It's a very huge.
Huge.
And it's just, I don't know if kids and their parents understand that. I don't know how many times I've advised that kids who are thinking about playing sports in college between their junior and senior year, they definitely have to go and look at the colleges they're interested in and go and watch some of the practices of the kids on the team, the sport they play on, because even at the D3 level, most high school kids are going to be surprised at how talented those kids are.
That's fantastic advice. They should all do that so they get more educated on the process. Few do it, but that would throw you light years ahead of knowing where you stack up if you actually did that legwork.
Wayne, I have a few more minutes left, and I know you're kind enough to come on the show tonight because you have a presentation this evening at 7, but I have to ask you this. You know, we know that college coaches really don't recruit anymore at the high school level in terms of going out and watching the kids play in the games. They look to showcases, tournaments, whatever it might be. We know that's the way of the world these days. Is there any way that a sports parent can find a way to figure out which of the showcases or the big tournaments are worthwhile for the kids to go to? Because these things cost a lot of money.
Yeah, let me first just say that certainly I still think high school sports still carry some weight, especially in certain sports, and college coaches will try to go watch the high school playoffs. Like a lot of times if a college coaches didn't make their own playoffs, now they have time earlier in the year and they'll actually go out and watch the kind of the finals of the high school sports where there's really good competition and the best players are. So I wouldn't discount that. And secondly, so many of us will always still talk to the high school coach to get a recommendation about what kind of person and player that kid is, because we know the high school coach you know, they have no incentive other than to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the showcases, my God, it's become overwhelming. And the best advice I could give in a short period of time here is if you start to know the schools that you like, ultimately, if you go to their particular camp, so if you have Bucknell as one of your top five schools and you play field hockey, there's nothing you could do that's better than going to the Bucknell prospect camp. You're going to be on their campus. You're going to meet their coaches. You'll meet players on the team. The college coach knows you like the school because you're enrolling in their camp, whereas there's many events that us college coaches go to, and we see some kids that we like, but we call them and we find out they don't like us or our school. So we can't do tryouts, so just keep that in mind. You can't go to Duke or North Carolina and just try out for a coach. So that's why camps are what they are in the first place. And ultimately, when you're targeted on the schools that you want, you should go to their camps. If not, then I would just go word of mouth. I would ask some players or parents that have attended events in the past, did the coaches that were said that were going to be there, did they show up? Was it run well? Did you get the exposure you were explained? Because otherwise, you're just going to go to a website, see what looks shiny and bright, and you're going to pick that, and it might not be a fit for you.
Yeah. And very quickly, Wayne, your views on the commercial recruiting services, some are free, some charge a lot of money. Are those worthwhile?
I really have done a lot of research with different coaches about how they recruit since I coach baseball. And I want to, when I do write my books and do these talks, I want to know if I'm kind of speaking to the way most coaches recruit. The only coaches I know that really have ever used recruiting services are generally bigger time football and basketball coaches that actually subscribe to finding the best 300 football players in the country or the best 300 basketball players in the country.
Okay.
The rest of us, unfortunately, don't log on to a computer and just find the perfect fits. So I would be very wary of any recruiting service. I understand parents don't get the help that they need. So they go, oh my God, I want to do what's right for my child. And they sign up for these services, but no college coach is looking for their recruits on these sites. It's just old fashioned hard work, being a talented player and, you know, trying to be seen live and maybe some video, but recruiting services just really don't work.
Very sound advice as always. Hey, Wayne, thank you again. Obviously, friends, if you have questions about recruiting, I urge you to track down Wayne Mazzoni at Sacred Heart University. He's a longtime pitching coach there, but as you've heard, he knows a lot about the whole process of recruiting. Wayne, I'm sure we'll talk to you down the road in the coming months as well.
Absolutely, Rick, and I love your show, and I hope there's more nights like this because it's great.
Thank you, Wayne. Okay, let's take a quick break. When I come back after Erica Herskowitz's update, we're going to be talking with Roman Oben, the former NFL star whose son, RJ, is a top football player at Duke University.
This is the Sports Edge with Rick Wolf on your flagship station for New York sports, The Fan, Sports Radio 66 and 101.9 FM, WFAN, New York.
My next guest this evening is the longtime NFL star Roman Oben, who played offensive tackle for well over a decade and won a Super Bowl championship with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Roman is also a local sports parent. His son, RJ, top football player in high school in New Jersey at St. Peter's, is now in his freshman year at Duke University. Roman, how are you this evening?
I'm doing good this evening. I'm calling you from Portland, Oregon at Nike headquarters, so they were gracious enough to give me a room to do this call.
Oh, that's terrific. And thank you for making time to talk with us this evening, Roman. Now, I want to talk quickly about your son, RJ, because I understand he had a shoulder surgery at the end of his season in the fall. Duke, can you give us a medical update and where he is now and how he's doing?
Well, thanks for your concern. Yeah, I think he had a partially torn labrum. They had to go in there and fix it. He got redshirted, and he'll be, you know, competing in the spring. He's got, I think there's two seniors, and he's the third end, I believe. But everybody's, all the coaches have said he's doing well, and he's a pleasure to coach, and he's doing all the right things. So I think when you talk about sports parenting as a parent, I said this the last time I was on your show, all you can do is kind of get him to the bus stop on time, and they eventually have to buy in on their own. And so I'm glad that he's bought in and he's doing well. He's not listening, but I'll send him the air check when the show's over.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, Roman, because, you know, every mom and dad whose son or daughter goes out to play competitive sports, there's always that unspoken assumption of the risk that with any sport, there's a chance that your youngster may go out and get injured. And it's just very, very difficult emotionally, not just for the boy or the girl who's playing, but for the parents as well. Now, particularly with you, because you played football for a good long time professionally, and looking at your son, who obviously had to go through a surgery for a torn labrum, how do you help him cope with all this? I mean, from your own career, what kind of advice do you give to your son that other sports parents could learn from?
Well, I think the first thing you have to do is just make sure you're approaching it not from a place of anxiety, but a place of just listening to the doctors, doing your own research. Obviously, I have the benefit of maybe asking my local Dr. McInerney in New Jersey, orthopedic, or some of those the Giants folks, sharing medical reports with some of my old team doctors. So I have the benefit of that, obviously. But as a parent, I think you just have to do your research, listen, and remove any anxiety or any doubt. And the good news is, with some of those types of injuries, a break, a tear, a partial tear, I mean, those are common injuries,
mm-hmm.
and things that are 100% recoverable. So, during the rehab process, you actually end up coming back stronger because you're working muscles around those joints that you've never really activated, and then your body starts to make up. And he's young enough, he's 18 still, young enough to recover, but it always starts again. Have the right information and just make sure you don't approach the process from a place of anxiety or fear, but a place of confidence. You've got to put confidence in your kid as well.
Yes, and those are good points about trying to get rid of the anxiety and trying to reassure your son or daughter that, in fact, they will get better. Obviously, it's difficult for any teenager to have to sit out when they realize they could be playing, but a great fear is that the kids come back too soon. But that's where, again, the medical advice is so critically important. And by the way, friends, we'll take calls as well, 1-877-337-6666. If you'd like to talk to Roman Oben about, his real-life job is he's the NFL's Vice President of Youth and High School Football Strategy. And Roman, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about what's the latest in terms from the National Football League in terms of youth concussions and concerns. And I know that it's been a number one topic for a long time. We know the numbers have dropped off the last few years at the high school level in terms of kids playing tackle football. But I keep reading reports about how there are new ways of trying to prevent concussions. For example, I know the NFL has reduced the number of practice sessions where there is contact. And other, college leagues like the Ivy League has pretty much eliminated all contact during the week. And it seems to be paying off. I mean, what do you, again, as a sports parent, as well as somebody who is a vice president with the NFL, what is your sense of what's happening with concussions?
Well, I think the when you talk about the concussion word itself, I think you have to just talk about head and neck injuries as a whole, shoulder injuries, all those injuries. Football obviously absorbs the common narrative of that discussion about concussions, but I think parents have to assume all the risks associated with playing sports.
Mm-hmm.
But I think from an NFL standpoint, your rule changes have been put in place that eliminate the tactics, techniques, all the unnecessary drills, the Oklahoma drills. I don't know if you knew that the Commissioner Goodell came out with a statement earlier in the year that they're prohibiting the use of the Oklahoma drill, kind of like the one-on-one and everybody jumping around and hoopla. I mean, that has no place in the game itself, and I think we have to make sure that as we become, smarter with things, we have to better technology, and we have to coach better. We have to teach better. And then so we have to make sure there's protocol. Every state has their own protocol rules for concussion,
right.
Recognition response. I mean, you leave those to the medical experts, but I certainly don't think football should be the only sport that takes the concussion discussion, but I think football is also led in best practices, research, working with all the companies, your helmet companies, your manufacturers, to make sure that equipment's getting better and we're also getting smarter about how we're dealing with the subject.
Well, I think the point you make about getting smarter, I mean, there every few months we hear there's a new helmet that's being produced. And all the helmet manufacturers are pretty clear about this, that they cannot prevent concussions because that's just not the way the human head is put together. But they are doing the best they can to minimize the impact. But I've been watching what they've been doing with the, especially in the Ivy League, where they pretty much have just wiped out. There's no contact during practice week at all. And instead, especially at Dartmouth, they've been using tackling dummies that are computerized with sensors in them. And it hasn't had any negative impact at all in terms of Dartmouth's success in the Ivy League, in the sense that they've become a dominant powerhouse over the last few years. So this seems this is curious as how this is all playing out.
Well, I mean, Buddy Tevens, who's the head coach of Dartmouth, has really been a genius in launching this, and I mean, you almost wish this would be done across the board.
Yeah,
I think athletes are better. We're coaching using a lot of better, like your tackling rings, and you talk about the MVP tackling dummy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't have to tackle to the ground. You don't have to go live in practice. You know, I come from that era, unfortunately, and when everything was live, every drill was live.
Yeah.
And so you look at what's going on in states like New Jersey, where you have limited time of just live tackling. I think no more than 30 minutes a week. So if you look at all the drills that are done, a high school drill or a high school practice, you can stay on your feet. So your coach, they stay on your feet. Your coach to kind of have control of FUD. You use a lot of bag work, so you're still having contact, but you're just not having contact with each other. And then you're playing better at the end of the season. You know, there's nothing worse than the old days where you're hitting in training camp, and then by the time you get to November, December, you're missing tackles, people were sluggish. You know, you want to be playing fresh at the end of the season, especially defensively. This is still football, right? It's still blocking, tackling. But again, what Buddy Tevens has done at Dartmouth, he's really set the precedence for what a lot of college football and definitely high school football has been doing in many states.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's been remarkable what he's been doing and able to accomplish in this sort of unique situation where he's eliminated the physical contact pretty much to get away from, you know, head and neck injuries and concussions. It's extraordinary. Hey, 1-877-337-6666. Let's take some calls. Let's go to Mike out in East Rockaway. Hey, Mike, you're on the Fan.
How you doing, Rick?
Good, Mike. How are you?
This is a treat. I'll tell you, a two-hour show. I'm picking up on your app from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
Great.
And Roman, are you still there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, great speaking and listening to you and have a chance to speak with you and the whole audience about, you know, Rick's show covers from A to Z. And this is a treat for everybody. But in your NFL background and coaching and seeing the new generation of football players, you know, concussions and protocol, it's really, you know, getting to the point where some moms and dads are hesitant, but the right teaching and instruction. I have a son that graduated 3 years ago. He was a wide receiver in college, and some nephews and friends' sons. And, you know, it's amazing. I try to tell friends to listen to Rick's show. And your contributions, Roman, can only enhance the feelings that parents have when the kids are a certain age. And it's so important, you know.
Yeah. Mike, thank you for the thoughts. And, yeah, I appreciate the call as always. And Roman, I'll just chime in as well, because I agree with Mike. You know, it doesn't surprise me that you're the NFL's vice president of youth and high school football strategy, because, yeah, you see the future of the game. Obviously, you have a son who plays the game at a D1 level. You play the game for a long time. If football is going to survive and to get through these difficult times with parental concerns about concussions, they're going to have to find new solutions. And as you said, people like Buddy Tevens at Dartmouth, this may be the way out of the woods. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, and again, when you talk about young children and the participation ages and you look at the different states that are having the discussion about when kids should play, at the league office, we believe in parents' choice. You've got different ages, different stages of kids' development, and we don't believe in mandating an age, if you will, but parents should choose. Parents have a right to choose, but again, that starts with having the right information.
Yes.
And so, you know, at some point, your kid's not 5, 6 years old anymore. That kid wants to play, and we believe in playing flag as an entry point. We believe in, if you're down south and or wherever, Midwestern parts of the country where football is kind of king, and they're not playing lacrosse as much or other sports, you might want to play tackle football younger. But it just starts with just being well-informed, having the right information. you know, doing anything you can to alleviate that parent's anxiety, and obviously moms are at the front of that. I had my older son didn't play till seventh grade. My younger son played at fifth grade. I didn't play till high school, but it wasn't because we had determined ages. It was just where we were in our interest level, playing different sports, growing your athletic ability, and I think every parent has the right to make that decision for his or her son or daughter. But again, I'll reiterate the fact that you just don't want to base it on an article that came out and some study that was shown. And I think we just have to make sure we're well-educated about our local leagues, our local coaches. Are they certified? What's their protocols? Coaches should have parents' meetings in the spring to educate all the moms and dads. And so those are the ways that you can well-equip yourself for success for your son or daughter.
We're talking with Roman Oben, and we're going to take a quick pause. Erica has the update. Roman, when we come back, I'm going to take some calls, so stay with me.
The Sports Leader, Sports Radio 101.9 FM, The Fan, and Sports Radio 66, WFAN.
We're talking right now with Roman Oben, the NFL's Vice President of Youth and High School Football Strategy, and as promised, Roman, let's go right back to our callers. Let's go to Mike in Cedar Grove. Hey, Mike, you're on The Fan.
Hey, how you doing? Pleasure to be on. It's a great show. You know, I enjoy the topic of the youth sports and the coaching and parenting aspect of the show, so kudos to you on that.
Thank you.
Roman, I had the pleasure to meet you years ago. One of your boys was in the junior wrestling program, and I was running one of the other programs in town with a few other guys. And it was great to see you out there, a guy with your experience and your ability, watching your son, who I believe only started maybe a couple of years. I don't think he had a lot of experience moving into his eighth grade year. And watching you work with him and watch him develop was a pleasure. And so I really appreciate that as a coach, being around all these parents. You know, it's getting tougher and tougher to stay involved with the youth programs, with the parenting, and the concussions are a really big part of it. We take that serious. You know, in our town, we offer concussion screening, you know, baseline testing for the kids. And surprisingly enough, less than 25% of the people take us up on it.
I mean, they don't want to get their kids baseline with concussions?
Yeah, they just won't take them there to get the baseline testing done for the concussions. But, you know, I think football gets a bad rap. I mean, we teach the USA heads-up technique and the hawk technique. There's all different things you do. And like you said, in Jersey, you know, you're not allowed to, you know, you only have limited amount of contact. I'm no longer with the program. It's just years ago that I was with the program. There's other guys taking over. I'm sure they're following suit now. But, you know, I've noticed being involved with the wrestling program, concussions are just as prevalent in the wrestling program.
Well,
let's say the soccer program or
yes.
The, you know, it's just not football.
Mike, I'm glad you mentioned that, and thank you for your call this evening. And Roman, let's make this clear. Yes, football gets a lot of attention with concussions, but the fact is any parent knows that if your youngster is playing ice hockey, soccer, baseball, basketball, even cheerleading, concussions are commonplace. They don't get the same kind of attention as football does. But every parent has to understand that if you can have your youngster tested at a baseline with impact testing, that's important. And if your kid does suffer a head injury, a concussion, it's important, no matter what sport it may be, they got to make sure that they get full medical attention right away.
Yeah, you're asking me?
Yes, Rowan, I'm sure you agree with that, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely. And I think I think the impact test started in sixth grade. So if you do one in sixth grade, I think you're 11 or 12. It lasts for 2 years just to get a baseline. And
yep.
And again, that word is just it invokes fear and anxiety on behalf of parents. But again, no one wants to see their child have an injury or any of those issues. But again, you also want to make sure that you're well equipped with the knowledge in case something does happen. And that's why I credit states like New Jersey and. Literally every town, every school district has some sort of protocol. So, and I'm glad the caller in Cedar Grove mentioned all the different sports that they're involved in. My kids play all different sports, lacrosse, wrestling, soccer. Obviously, we tried a little bit of everything just to just kind of get that appetite because sports grow confidence, you know, builds teamwork, character. We obviously believe football is the greatest of those. Not that you can't get those from any other sports, but I think no other sport you know, where you start the season in the summers in August, you end it maybe 15, 20 degrees at the end of the season or whatever level you're playing. But
yeah.
I think we definitely believe that football encompasses team and all those things. But parents absolutely have to be informed. It can't be a New York Times article. It's not on the commissioner or myself. It's on every single parent to make sure that they're putting their son or daughter, you know, in the best position to succeed.
I couldn't agree more. And Roman, I first of all, it's such always a pleasure to talk to you about your views when it comes to not only, you know, football, but obviously as a sports parent as well. And I realize you're out in Portland, Oregon. I thank you so much for taking the time to join me this evening. Continue good luck to RJ and his football career at Duke. And again, Roman, we'll talk to you, I'm sure, in the months to come.
My pleasure. I'll be in the studio next time. Just make sure you lock me in.
Okay, we'll do that. Thank you, Roman. That's Roman Oben, the NFL's Vice President of Youth and High School Football Strategy. Really good man. Okay, let me take another time out. When I return, we'll be joined by Sonia Curry, who is, well, she's a sports mom, but she's not just any sports mom. Stay with me.
The Fan Sports Radio 101.9 FM. Sports Radio 66. Sports Radio WFAN.
And welcome back to this very special edition of the Sports Edge. I'm your host, Rick Wolf. My next guest this evening is a sports mom. But as I mentioned, well, she's not just any sports mom. Sonia Curry, who was a top high school and collegiate athlete herself, has three kids who grew up to be superb athletes themselves. Her daughter, Seidel, played D1 volleyball at Elon College, and her sons are Steph and Seth Curry, both of whom are top college basketball players and, of course, now star in the NBA. And Sonia is married to Del Curry. He, too, a longtime NBA star and was a pretty fair baseball player as well. Sonia, really good to talk to you. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, Rick?
I am fine. Thank you for taking the time to join me this evening. I want to talk, obviously, about at a time when your kids were growing up, long before they became superstars. And I know, of course, you were an outstanding athlete in basketball and volleyball and track as a kid, and you end up yourself playing volleyball at Virginia Tech. Tell me about your own involvement in sports and how, as you grew up, how you felt that was going to influence you when you became a sports parent.
I think just involvement. I mean, for me, when I was growing up, you know, sport was an outlet to, one, have something to do, two, to, you know, belong to a community of like-minded people through sport, and just to, you know, be busy, and then long term to actually have the opportunity to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I come from just, you know, a small town where my family was, we were athletes. We were known to be the best athletes in the area. So, you know, I had some big shoes to follow myself in Radford, Virginia, growing up. So, you know, it's just in our blood. So we knew that our children would be, you know, athletically inclined, just because both Del and I were. And so we wanted them to just be active and just involved and productive as kids. And sports provided that opportunity for them.
Well, the reason I ask this is because, and certainly you must be aware of this, it seems these days all over the country, every sports parent somehow believes that the sooner they can get their youngster, their young athlete to specialize in just one sport and get on to an elite travel team and play that one sport all year round, that somehow that's going to get them to a higher level. It's going to accelerate their abilities in that sport. But I mean, your kids obviously played a variety of sports as they were growing up, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And so we don't think that way. We're a little old school, and, you know, just the industry now, and that's what I feel like a lot of the travel clubs and AAU and all of that has really become, it's an industry.
Sure.
That they are forcing these kids to do that. And they're putting a lot of pressure on the parents to also think that way. But, you know, we didn't. We felt like that our children should, you know, experience all different types of sports. When they got in middle school, that they should play more than one sport, that they should cross train their bodies,
mm-hmm.
and also just get to know, different types of athletes, because, you know, you've got tennis, you've got football and basketball and baseball, and it all takes, you know, a different type of mentality, each sport. And we wanted them to be able to experience both of that and to prevent burnout, because that's what's happening nowadays is kids are just, they're getting burned out and they're losing the joy of the sport. And so a lot of kids are getting turned off way too early. I also think that they're burning their bodies out as well by not playing more than one sport and developing every aspect of their physical bodies.
Well, we're talking right now with Sonia Curry, who is the mom to three outstanding athletes, including Steph, Seth, and Seidel, a daughter who played the D1 level at Elon College. You know, I hear you about this. I just want to take a step back about the whole concept when your kids were, you know, preteens and whatever, and they're playing a variety of sports. They were not specializing. And I had read somewhere that your kids were not, they were not necessarily the biggest kids on their teams. In fact, they were the smaller kids. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. But, you know, I I'm still only 5'5" and a half, but I developed late as well, matured lately. Dell did the exact same thing. Dell grew a couple of inches in college as well. So we knew that our children were going to be late bloomers in general. And that's what happened with them is that, you know, Stefan, his junior year into his senior year, maybe he grew from like 5'6" to maybe 5'8", 5'9". And then his freshman year in college, he then took off between his freshman year in college to his junior year. And actually, honestly, we say 3 years into his NBA career, he even grew another inch. So even that late into his development, was Stefan really still growing? So,
you know, it's funny you mentioned that too, because and I don't have any empirical evidence to prove this, but I've also noticed it seems that kids, we know about late bloomers, and traditionally they'd say, well, a kid grows between his, I don't know, junior or senior year in high school. But I've noticed, as you said, kids continue to grow right through college and sometimes into their early 20s.
Absolutely.
And, you know, that's something that I think, you know, a lot of parents these days, and I know you run a school and an educator yourself, a lot of parents have said, well, I'm just going to hold my kid back a year before they start kindergarten or first grade. So they're the oldest and the more physically mature kids in their class. I don't know if that's good, bad, or indifferent, but I do know, as we just said, a lot of kids are late bloomers. It seems they'd be blossoming more than ever. We're talking with Sonia Curry. And by the way, friends, after Erica Herskowitz and her update, we're going to take some calls for Sonia at 1-877-337-6666, talking about this extraordinary sports family. And as I said, it's just remarkable that these kids, as Sonia was just mentioning, her kids have all grown up to be top athletes. They weren't necessarily the biggest kids on their teams, and they played a variety of sports. And again, that just sort of runs contrary to the basic tenets these days of parents saying, no, 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 you got to specialize, you got to be one of the bigger kids. It's just, and the other thing you mentioned too, Sonia, which I think is so critically important, is the whole idea of joy. I worry these days that kids don't seem to have the same kind of sense of joy or fun playing sports. It's as simple as that. All right, let me take a pause here. As I said, Erica has your update. When I return, we'll take your calls at 1-877-337-6666. And welcome back to the Sports Edge, a special edition this Thursday evening. My guest right now is Sonia Curry, and we're talking about being a sports mom, and she's had an extraordinary career, if you will, at raising three outstanding athletes. And as I promised, we're going to take some calls for Sonia at 1-877-337-6666. Let's go to our friend Jack over in Fairlawn, New Jersey. Jack, good evening. You're on the Fan.
Thanks, Rick, for getting me on. I've been sitting in my car listening. I didn't want to break the connection. I'd like to just say hello to all my players at Montclair and the coaching staff, and I'm so glad you put me on in this segment. Sonia, you know, old school, in my eyes, seems to be the best. I mean, when kids used to go out and play, they played every sport, they tried everything. You know, I'm a little familiar with your son, especially Steph. He was coached by a very good friend of mine who coached with the Golden State Warriors for years, a guy named Mark Rabo. But, it's so funny because specializing is something that, you know, I'm definitely against, and I'm a private coach. I'm coaching at the college level now, and I'm a private coach, but I make sure that my kids take breaks. I have a theory or a definition of specializing, and it doesn't mean to play all year. It just means when you've finally chosen that one sport that you should train all year. And, you know, training means, you know, staying in shape for that sport, but also playing every other sport. I had two excellent athletes as sons. One played pro baseball. They both played all the way through high school, three sports. My younger decided not to play. The older pursued professional baseball for 8 years, and they played, like, all the way through. So, you know, listening about your sons and your daughter, and the funny thing about it is I'm a Hall of Fame coach on the female side. I was a softball and women's soccer coach at the high school level.
Wow.
And that's my claim to fame, even though I had two great boy athletes. So, you know, I give you a lot of credit as a mother, because I understand that the mothers do most of the work. The fathers sit back and take all the accolades, but the mothers are the workers. So, you know, I appreciate you coming on tonight. And, Rick, once again, I'm going to keep this short if that's possible. This 2-hour show is needed on a more regular basis, because I've gotten, just sitting in my car waiting to get on, I've gotten about 20 texts about how unbelievable this is that the WFAN is doing this. So, Sonia, congratulations on your three beautiful children, athletes, and on yourself and your husband. And
thank
you. Old school is the best. Thank you so much, Jack.
Jack, thank you for the kind thoughts and great, appreciate it. Sonia, go ahead, Sonia.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Ben.
I was going to just ask you, because Jack was talking about, we know the moms do all the heavy lifting, all the work. How did you get your kids to practices? How did you chauffeur them around and work out schedules to make sure they were on practices and games?
Well, you know, coaches would help too. So if I was at work and I couldn't get all three of them to where they would go, we had great coaches who would come by and pick them up. I did have a babysitter who could also help with mm-hmm. that as well. And then, of course, when they got older, they could drive themselves, which I loved. It was like, thank you, Jesus. But, you know, I want to touch on one of the things, you know, Dell and I are doing a podcast called Raising.
I was just going to mention that, and I'm so glad you mentioned, because this new podcast you've started with Dell called Raising Fame.
Sports Edition.
Tell us about that, because it's so applicable to what we're discussing this evening.
Exactly. And we've had the opportunity to travel all over the country and interview right now about 17 parents, whether single parents, dual parents, grandparents, adoptive parents, of high-profile athletes, from Serena Venus Williams' mom to Patrick Mahomes' mom to Shaq's mother, and so forth and so on. And, you know, talking about cross-training, you know, all of these athletes have been in more than one sport.
Mm-hmm.
Patrick Mahomes, you know, could have played baseball.
Sure.
And football wasn't even his first choice, and look what he's doing now. His mom had to really force him to stay in football his junior year. And so same thing with my husband, you know, being getting drafted for baseball and
sure.
football. Same thing with Russell Wilson, who that podcast just came out on Tuesday with his mom, Tammy Wilson. So, you know, there's something to be said for a well-rounded athlete, because athletes at this level that, you know, we're interviewing, they're pure athletes. They're just not basketball players. They're just not football players or baseball players. They're athletes.
And you know, it's funny.
That's what we should focus on.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's so odd to me that when people like yourself, who obviously this is your life, you know exactly how you raised your kids, and with the new podcast, Raising Fame, Sports Edition, all these top athletes, all their parents are saying the same thing. My youngster exactly. did not specialize. My kid played a variety of sports and probably decided what sport they wanted to play when they were, I don't know, a junior or sophomore in high school. But it's just the parents, for the most part, don't listen to this or don't believe it because they feel that if their youngster does specialize at a very early age, that somehow that's going to give them a leg up. But again, as we discussed, Sonia, that leads to burnout. It leads to repetitive use injuries. It's a real concern.
Right. And you, and the issue is that it's a lot of parents, and that's what the Raise and Fame Sports Edition is about, is to kind of build a community where parents can just glean some advice. You know, you don't have to recreate the wheel. You don't feel like you're in this by yourself, that here are people who have gone through this journey already. And you can trust the process of, you know, letting your kids be kids first and foremost, letting them, you know, enjoy their sport, what they start, they need to finish. And, you know, through all of this is the simple fact that there's a lot of pressure coming from the outside world, from how they schedule now, even in high school, back to back to back. If you play football and you make it to the state championship, basketball's already started.
Of course.
These kids feel peer pressure that they're missing out with the bonding aspect of the, you know, the other team that they're going to be joining. My daughter ran into that where she felt like, and this is more so in female sports because, you know, the social aspect of the sport is very important to females. She was like, Mom, but I'm going to be 2 weeks behind. They've already been practicing together. And I'm like, babe, if you're good enough, you can show up and you can pick up where you need to. you're already in shape because you're coming from another sport. So it's not about getting in shape. It's just about, you know, coming in and playing your role and knowing what that is. And so, you know, I just want to encourage parents just not to feel the pressure, not to succumb to the pressure. If their children are good enough to play, they need to play several sports, and it's going to be okay. I just want to say that it's going to be okay.
It is such sage advice, and we're talking with Sonia Curry about that, you know, because parents do feel that, after all, they focus on their children, their flesh and blood, and they want the very best for the kids, which are all wonderful sentiments, but they begin to sense that, well, maybe my kid is not going to be good enough to be the starter or be the best player on the team. And you know how this goes. The parents get nervous, and maybe we should talk to the coach or do this or do that. And it's this is why I think people sort of get sucked into this sense that, well, it's better just to specialize on one sport because at least that way I know the kid is on the fast track. Now, Sonia, let me ask you, because obviously you're involved in sports your entire life. You look around and you must see a lot of sports parents in your community who are doing the same thing, that they don't, they just are so focused on my kid is going to be the next superstar. It has to concern you in terms of the fact they're putting so much pressure on their youngsters.
I mean, it really does. Della and I were involved in starting an AAU team in Charlotte when the kids were younger that Stefan played at starting at 9 years of age. And so you can imagine starting an AAU program in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's several others. And then around about 12 years of age or 13 years of age, you start hearing the rumblings and parents, you know, my child's not playing enough. And then they start moving to different AAU teams.
Right.
They think they start their own AAU team. And, you know, unfortunately, it's a delicate line to really walk with parents because, you know, they believe in their children, right?
Sure.
And who are you to say not to believe in your child? But, you know, at some certain point, you know, being able to see their talent and their skill for what it is. And a lot of times with that, it is the parent trying to live vicariously through their child.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see the lack of passion in the child. And unfortunately, the parents will keep forcing them to do it. The kids will feel pressure to continue in that sport. And it's just not a good, this is not a good scene. So, yes, we've seen that happen. And unfortunately, that never really works out for anyone.
No.
The child, the athlete, or the parent. And so it's not a good situation at all.
No, once the youngster, as you said, and any parent, if they're being honest, they can see themselves that once the youngster loses that sense of joy, and you can see it in their face and their eyes, it's pretty much over, because there's not much you can say to a youngster when they sort of decided for themselves, this is not where I want to be. And that's
exactly.
Pretty much, and that can be as young as 10 or 12 or 13 years old. And that is a real concern. And it's unfortunately, parents say, well, you know, the thing is, my kid has great talent, but I can't seem to find the right words to motivate them. Well, unfortunately, mom and dad, there are no words. Either they want to play or they don't. And you have to sort of come to grips with the fact that maybe your youngster is not isn't born with that innate drive to be successful in sports. And again, you mentioned before about the late bloomer syndrome. Yeah, that's a real thing. Parents have to understand your kid might be small now, but they may grow over the next 4, 5, 6, 7 years. Sonia, I was going to say, I wish I had more time. Obviously, I'm just delighted and thrilled that you found the time to come and join me on the show tonight talking about the future of sports parenting. I mean, I think this is great. And again, I want to remind our listeners about Raising Fame Sports Edition. It's a brand new podcast. It is terrific, in which you and Dell talk to these other athletes and to their families about how they grew up playing sports. You can find Raising Fame Sports Edition on radio.com and pretty much where all the other podcasts are available as well. And Sonia, really just a delight to talk to you about these very important sports parenting issues.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Sweeting.
Well, thank you. Again, Sonia, as I said, continued success with your amazingly athletic family. it really must be great fun to watch your kids go out and play a variety of sports. Thank you, Sonia.
Take care.
You too. Take care. All right, let me take a pause. When I return after the update from Erica, we will talk to Dr. James Andrews about sports injuries and kids and baseball. So stay with me. Back with more after this.
This is the Sports Edge with Rick Wolf on your flagship station for New York sports. The Fan, Sports Radio 66 and 101.9 FM, WFAN, New York.
Well, if you follow sports, you certainly know the name of Dr. James Andrews. He's considered the leading orthopedic surgeon, handling the biggest name in sports, and his insights and in medical opinions are held in only the highest esteem. I can't even begin to tell you how many times I've referenced Dr. Andrews and the American Sports Medical Institute on the Sports Edge over the years, and I am just honored to have Dr. Andrews join us tonight. And friends, we'll try to get some of your calls in as well for Dr. Andrews, 1-877-337-6666. Dr. Andrews, how are you tonight?
I'm doing great. It's a real pleasure to be able to be with you tonight, Rick.
Well, I know how busy you must be, and I just, again, thank you so much for taking a few minutes of your time. Let's get right into this. Let's talk about kids and pitching, and you know, there's been so much in the last few years about concerns with kids and Tommy John surgery. I'm talking about kids who are teenagers. What can you tell, what do you tell parents of kids who, kids obviously these days, they want to throw at max speed, max velocity, and they often hurt their arm. What do you advise coaches and parents to tell the young pitchers?
Well, I could preface my remarks by letting you know that young athletes have become more and more vulnerable at all levels in all, say, 29 youth sports, which is a $5 to $6 billion sports industry.
Mm-hmm.
And youth baseball is the one that we've have paid most attention to, and we've seen a tenfold increase in youth baseball injuries across the board since year 2000.
Wow.
For example, you talked about the Tommy John's injury, the ulnar collateral ligament injury.
Yes.
Back when we first started doing that some 30, 40 years ago, professional baseball players were the ones, mostly major leaguers, that had that injury.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, in year 2000, I think I did about 9 Tommy Johns on adolescent athletes, high school and younger, that year. And this last year, I did over 150 in high school.
Jeez.
And the numbers have flip-flopped so that the largest number now doing having that particular procedure done are high school and younger baseball players, of course, mostly pitchers. So it's really become an epidemic. And the two things you mentioned, there are lots of reasons for this, but the two things that stand out are fatigue and high velocity.
Yep.
They're all trying to throw 90 miles per hour. They're all pitching year-round with year-round fatigue, event fatigue, seasonal fatigue. And if they have that type of fatigue phenomenon with high velocity, there's about a 36-to-1 times increased injury to either the shoulder or the elbow, as documented by our research at ASMI. So there lies the big problem.
It's just heartbreaking because we understand, of course, the kids, obviously, they want to impress college coaches, they want to impress baseball scouts, and they assume that unless they throw 90 miles an hour, full max, all the time, that they're not going to get looked at or considered to be good enough to get to the next level. And, of course, it's just a really terrible situation, as you well know, since you're in the front lines working with these kids and having to operate on them. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work. It doesn't make sense. And yet we don't really see any of these kids or their coaches or their parents saying, look, let's take this reasonably and do the right thing for your arm and your elbow and be careful. I mean, it's just because the truth is, when I read, not all Tommy John surgeries are successful when it comes to kids. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, the hardest group to get through this particular operation are the young adolescent baseball players. Number one, they miss a considerable period of time in their development as baseball players when they have this injury and finally get operated on. So they miss out on their development. They try to rush themselves back into their sport before
right.
they're well, and then they have relapses and wind up having a failure. It's hard on them psychologically, too, because it's an adult operation, and these kids, certainly most of them, are just young kids that really have aspiration to play baseball. Parents are pushing them hard. And when they get hurt, they have no real idea about what they're really getting into.
Yeah.
So it's a sad situation, to be honest with you.
We're talking with Dr. James Andrews, the noted orthopedic surgeon, about kids and kids who obviously aspire to play baseball at a higher level and the problems they run into with their arms and shoulders and elbows. Dr. Andrews, I waited a long time to ask you this. I read on several occasions where you have been quoted as saying that kids really should not throw curveballs or sliders until they're old enough to shave. Do you still subscribe to that philosophy?
Absolutely, but I'm telling you, that's not what's going on. The reason I say that, we studied the biomechanics of the young kids throwing a curveball in our biomechanics lab.
Yes.
Here with Glenn Flasig and at ASMI. And if they throw curveballs with proper mechanics, there's no greater stress on the elbow than throwing a fastball. The problem is these young kids that are growing don't have the neuromuscular control, and they're not perhaps taught properly with good mechanics, and therefore when they throw a curveball, they get hurt. So they're just not old enough to throw a sophisticated pitch, and you'd be surprised when you said curveball. You could throw slider in there too.
Yes, exactly.
It's a shame. And I see daddies out there at youth baseball games where my little grandson's playing in the fourth grade, for example, last summer.
Yeah.
He was in the third grade that summer. And the daddy was the coach of the opposing team, and his son was pitching. And the daddy was calling the pitches, and he was calling a curveball about every other or every third pitch. Well, this young kid in the third grade to throw because he was striking the batters on my son's team out. And the daddy was calling the pitches. So you understand the problem.
You know, it's because, you know, every year we watch the Little League Baseball and they're televised, the games, the playoff games in Williamsport. It's more and more apparent over the last 10 years, at least, that these pitchers are all, every other pitch, to your point, is a curveball or a slider. The commentators refer to them as breaking balls, although somehow that makes it the pitches safer. But you have to wonder, you know, when these kids are throwing so many curveballs and sliders at such a young age, this can't bode well for the future health of their arms.
Well, you know, most kids get away with it sometimes because they're selected out,
yes,
genetically, and they're also physiologically much older than their 12-year-old age group. Some of them are already taller than the adult umpire. That when you see them on TV, they're 6 feet tall. They're already shaven because they're physiologically way beyond their anatomical age.
Mm-hmm.
And in those cases, they're up on the mound pitching, and they're throwing curveballs. The ones I'm talking about are much younger than that, though, throwing curveballs. So we've tried to talk to the people at ESPN to quit complimenting them about their curveball and quit talking about it on TV, because that promotes people that really can't throw it properly from trying to throw a curveball. So get that point across if you can up in New York, and maybe we can quit emphasizing that in the World Series. I've been on the board of Little League International for, I'm off now, but I was on there 12 years, and we tried to control that concept, but we didn't do a very good job about it.
Well, those are the words of Dr. James Andrews. You're not going to find anybody who's more skilled and more experienced when it comes to the health and welfare of kids' arms than Dr. Andrews. And as promised, let's get some calls in. Our time is tight, but let's go to Mike up in Cheshire. Hey, Mike. Good evening. You're on WFAN.
Hey, I work in healthcare, and I was just wondering what Dr. Andrews' opinion was, or protocol was, for the weekend warrior who's done well post-op with a lower extremity injury and would like to return to running.
Would like to return to running?
Correct.
Okay. Are we talking about kids or talking about grown-ups here, Mike?
Middle-aged.
Okay. Well, Dr. Andrews, is that...
Basically, weekend warriors, you know, they're notorious for being tough and abusing themselves and getting hurt playing. You know, we call them flashback athletes. And they remember how they could swing a bat or a slide or throw a baseball when they were in high school or perhaps in college. And now they're 45 years old, maybe a little bit older, and they're trying to play either softball or maybe even baseball or whatever they might be playing, basketball, and they get hurt. And they think they can brace through it, and they come back on an injury without being seen. There's no athletic trainer there to check them. The basic information is that when you have swelling and pain in a joint or you've been hurt as a weekend warrior, you need to check out your sports medicine physician in your community. Usually a primary care sports medicine physician or maybe even an orthopedist doing sports medicine, and get the proper treatment so you don't turn a small injury into a much more complicated and serious injury. And that's what we see all the time with weekend warriors. They do get hurt, believe me.
Mike, thank you for the call. Let's go quickly over to Charlie in Oyster Bay, New York. Hey, Charlie, you're on the Fan.
Hey, thank you so much. I enjoy your show so much whenever it's on. And Dr. Andrews, thank you so much for pursuing the profession you have done. I heard on the radio you said you did 150 procedures this year alone. I'd like to know how many in that youth group nationwide. I'm sure you're not the only doctor who does this.
The Tommy John.
How prevalent?
We're in the process of trying to get a registry so we know how many are done in the high school age group.
Wow.
And we have not been able to get that put together, but we're working on it. There used to be only three or four so-called Tommy John surgeons in the country. Now there are many, many, many more than that are doing this procedure. Obviously, the ones that I'm seeing are not all from my local area. They come from all over the 50 states. So when I talk about how many I do, it's a little bit of a skewed number because they're being referred here from a lot of different places. But I can tell you, it's way too many of them. It makes me very sad and sick at my stomach when I see a young
kid
age 12 that's torn a ligament in his elbow.
Well, I hope you can gather the brain trust together to put out more statistics so it can educate the parents of this country, because it's disheartening. I mean, I'm not talking about the Tommy John, but seeing young girls having ACL injuries time and time again, it's unbelievable. When I grew up in the 70s, it never was heard of.
Charlie, I gotta take a break here, but thank you for your call. And
thank you very much.
You bet. And Dr. Andrews, can I impose upon you to stay with us a few more minutes longer?
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Okay, we're talking with Dr. James Andrews. We're going to take a couple of commercial break here, and then have an update from Erica. When I return, I'll try to get back to your calls. Stay with me. And back here on the Sports Edge, I'm your host, Rick Wolf. We're talking right now with Dr. James Andrews. We're talking about youth injuries, and particularly with a focus on pitchers and the problems they're confronting these days when it comes to hurting their arms, shoulders, elbows, either throwing too many curveballs, sliders, Tommy John surgery. It's just very, very deplorable that we can't seem to get our youth coaches and parents understand how much danger they put their arms into. Let's right back to our call since our time is short here. Let's go to Tom up in Middletown. Hi, Tom. You're on the Fan.
Hey, Dr. Andrews, a real pleasure. I had a question. Growing up, I had used a lot of weighted baseballs in my training, and I felt it was very successful for me, and I was maybe ahead of the curve, so to speak, in my pitching development and strength of my arm. And sure enough, at the age of about 17, I had a labral tear and went my first surgery and then had my second one shortly thereafter in college. And I wanted your opinion on things of the nature with weighted training baseballs that you see being marketed and sold towards kids.
Well, unfortunately, we finally figured out, at least there's some guidelines when you start doing either underweighted baseball throws or overweighted baseball throws. And the problem with overweighted baseball throws, when you get up real heavy, it changes all of your mechanics of your throwing shoulder, and indeed there's an increased risk of injury to your shoulder or your elbow. So our recommendations today are: do not go heavier than a 7-ounce baseball when you go beyond the normal 5.5-ounce regular baseball. And some of these high school coaches are having them throw up to 16 ounces, even up to 2 pounds. Underweighted baseballs going down to like 3 ounces helps you accelerate your rotational effort and can also increase your speed. But going beyond 7 ounces in our research that we've done at ASMI and also our therapists and trainers up in Boston have also worked with me on research, and they've shown the same injury rate. So be careful with weighted baseballs. They're being used all over the country, and parents are buying into it, and actually buying into it is a word because it costs money to do the program, but they're buying into it because they're almost being guaranteed you'll gain 3-4 miles per hour with a weighted baseball program. The problem is, the injury rates go way up. And the two things that I see on young players coming in when I take their history that have had an injury, they're coming to see me, the two things that are the most common denominator for their injury are weighted baseball program, number one, and number two, long toss. 14-year-old kid being throwing long toss 300 feet, that changes your mechanics also. And the injury rates are related to those two problems out there.
Hey, Tom, that's a real good question you asked, and I thank you for checking in with us this evening. Dr. Andrews, again, our time, unfortunately, is short. I would certainly love to get you back on the show and down the road to talk more about kids and injuries and what really coaches, youth coaches, and parents need to know, because when you're telling the story about going to watch one of your grandsons play and he's in third or fourth grade and you're in the stands and the kids are throwing curveballs at such an early age, you would think that somebody somewhere would say, you know, that's Dr. Andrews over there. I don't think he wants our kids doing this stuff. You know, that's discouraging.
Well, it's a problem, but you know, the culture of youth sports is what's so hard to change.
Sure.
I've sat down and talked to my daughter, who has that young baseball player, now gone through the third grade, is in the fourth grade playing youth baseball. Tried to talk some sense into my daughter, and my son-in-law played baseball and was really good baseball player in high school, and I wound up having to operate on his elbow when he was in like the eighth or ninth grade, ruined his career. But you know what? They really won't listen to my recommendations, unfortunately, because Jeez. There's so much pressure by parents and coaches that they think that's the only way they can manage their kid. And so the culture of youth, particularly youth baseball, is awful difficult to change. And I understand from a parent and a grandparent how difficult it is to make those changes.
Yeah,
but it's a problem.
It is a major problem, and it's epidemic. Hey, Dr. Andrews, I can't thank you enough for taking time from your busy schedule to join me this evening. Just great insights, as we expected. And thank you. And again, we'll talk to you down the road.
Well, thank y'all.
You bet. That is Dr. James Andrews, everybody. And obviously, he is the man when it comes to dealing with sports injuries, arms, shoulders, elbows, you name it. Before I forget, I want to make sure you check out radio.com Rewind. And you can listen to any WFAN program you may have missed over the past 24 hours. All you have to do is download the radio.com app, select WFAN, and, you know, you can just pause and rewind any length or segment you choose, or take a listen to an entire show, like this one. It's the all-new radio.com Rewind. You can download the radio.com app now and rewind up to 24 hours so you can catch anything you may have missed. Listen to what you want and when you want. That's going to do it for this edition of the Sports Edge. My thanks to Wayne Mazzoni, Roman Oben, Sonia Curry, Dr. James Andrews, and of course to Brian Roscona for producing the show, and Sus Araki on the board. I'll see you this Sunday morning, 8 o'clock, right here on the Sports Edge.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it, with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.